in. The door's locked. At that, Caroline woke properly. Glancing at the clock, she saw that it was just after 8. The day was bright beyond the curtain, unnaturally bright because of the snowy ground. Alarmed, queasy, trembling with lack of sleep, she rose and went rapidly around the landing to her mother's room. Just as Betty had claimed, its door was closed and locked, and when she tapped on the door, lightly at first, but then more firmly, as her anxiety mounted, she received no answer.
"Mother?" she called. "Mother, are you awake?"
Still no reply. She beckoned to Betty. Could she hear anything? Betty listened, then shook her head. Caroline said, "She might, I suppose, be sleeping too deeply, but then the door, it was closed when you got up."
"Yes, miss."
"But I know, I remember, I'm sure I remember, that both the doors were open." "We don't have a spare key for this, do we?"
"I don't think so, miss."
"No, neither do I. Oh, God, why the hell did I leave her?" Trembling harder, she knocked on the door again, louder than before. Again, no answer. But then she thought to do what Mrs. Ayres herself had recently done when faced with an inexplicable locked door. She stooped and put her eye to the keyhole, and she was reassured to see that the keyhole was empty and the room beyond it quite light, for not unnaturally she took this to mean that her mother was not in the room at all. She must have locked the door when she left it and taken the key away with her. Why would she have done that? Caroline couldn't imagine. She got to her feet, and with more confidence than she felt, she said,
"I don't think my mother's in there, Betty. She must be somewhere in the house. I suppose you've been in the little parlour."
"Oh, yes, miss. I've been and laid the fire in there."
"She couldn't be down in the library, I suppose. And she wouldn't have gone upstairs, would she?"
She and Betty gazed at each other, both thinking back to that horrible incident of a few weeks before.
"I'd better go up and take a look," said Caroline at last. "Wait here for me."
"No, on second thoughts, don't wait here. Check all the rooms on this floor, then check downstairs. My mother might have had some accident." They went off in separate directions, Caroline running upstairs, then laboriously trying every door and calling out. The shady corridors didn't frighten her. She found the nurseries, as I had, bleak but lifeless and quite empty. Defeated, she returned to the door of her mother's room. A moment later, Betty joined her. She had also found nothing. She had tried every room, and she had looked from the windows, too, in case Mrs. Ayres had gone outside. There were no new footprints in the snow, she said, and Madam's coat, she added, was still on its peg in the porch, and her boots were dry on the rack. Caroline began to bite nervously at the tips of her fingers. Again she rattled the handle of her mother's door and knocked and called. Again nothing.
"God," she said, "this is no good. My mother must have gone outside. She must have gone before this latest fall of snow covered up her footprints."
"Without her coat and her boots?" asked Betty in horror. Again they looked at each other, then they turned and hurried down the stairs and drew back the bolts of the front door. The whiteness of the day almost blinded them, but they went as quickly as they could across the gravel, then right along the south terrace to the steps which led down to the lawn. Here, dazzled and frustrated by the unbroken blanket of snow with which the lawn was covered, Caroline came to a halt and peered across the garden. She cupped her hands to her mouth, calling,
"Mother? Mother? Are you there?"
"Mrs. Ayres," called Betty.
"Madam? Mrs. Ayres?"
They listened and heard nothing.
"We might try the old gardens," said Caroline, then moving forward again. "My mother was there yesterday with Dr. Faraday. I don't know, perhaps she took it into her head to go back."
But as she spoke, her eye was caught by a small imperfection in the snow ahead of her, and warily she moved towards it. Something had fallen there, some small metal object. She thought at first that it must be a coin, then realized as she drew closer that what she'd mistaken for a tilted shilling was actually the glittering oval end of a long-stemmed key. It was the key, she knew it had to be, to her mother's locked room, but how it had dropped or tumbled there into that unmarked stretch of snow she couldn't imagine. She could only think for one wild moment that it had slipped from the beak of a bird, and she lifted her eyes and turned her head in search of a magpie or a crow. What her gaze met instead were the windows of her mother's bedroom. One was closed, its curtains shut. The other was open, wide open to the frosty air. And her heart, at the sight of it, seemed to die in her breast, for suddenly she knew that the key was here because her mother herself, after locking her door from the inside, had thrown it out. She knew that her mother was still in her room and did not want to be easily found. And she guessed why.
She ran, then, just as soon I myself would be running, ran awkwardly back through the powdery snow, catching hold of a startled Betty and taking her with her, pulling her into the house and up the stairs. The key was as cold as an icicle in her fingers as she fitted it into the lock. Her hand was trembling so violently that for a second the metal wouldn't catch, and her leaden heart gave a desperate kick. She thought that, after all, she had made a mistake. The key was the wrong one, not her mother's at all. But then the lock shifted. She caught hold of the handle and pushed at the door. She felt it open an inch or two and then stop, as something behind it, something heavy and resistant, got in its path.
"For God's sake, help me!"
she cried in a terribly broken voice, and Betty moved forward to push the door with her until it had opened just far enough for them to be able to put in their heads and look behind it. What they saw made them both cry out. It was Mrs. Ayres, slumped and ungainly, her head lolling, her pose queer, as if she had sunk to her knees in a sort of half-faint just inside the threshold. Her face was hidden by her loose, greying hair, but as they pushed the door further, her head moved slackly to the side. Then they could see what she had done. She had hanged herself, with the cord of her dressing-gown, from an old brass hook on the back of the door. There followed several ghastly minutes as they tried to release her, to warm and revive her. The cord was drawn so tightly by her weight they couldn't unknot it. Betty had to run for scissors, and when she returned with kitchen shears they found the blades of them so dull they could only saw away at the thickly braided silk until it frayed, and then they had literally to prise the cord away from the swollen flesh of her throat. There is a particular horror to the appearance of a hanged person, and Mrs. Ayres looked dreadful, bloated and dark. She'd clearly been dead for some time. Her body was already cool, and yet, according to Betty, when I spoke to her later that day, Caroline bent over her, shaking and chiding her, not speaking gently or sorrowfully, but telling her, almost playfully, that she must wake up, must pull herself together.
"She didn't know what she was saying, sir,"
Betty said, sitting at the kitchen table and wiping her eyes.
"She went on shaking and shaking her, until I said perhaps we ought to get her up onto the bed. So between us we lifted Madam up."
She covered her face.
"Oh, my God, it were awful. She kept slipping out of our arms, and every time she did, Miss Caroline told her not to be silly, speaking just as she would have if Madam had done some ordinary thing, like losing her glasses. We got her lying down, and she looked worse than ever, with a white pillow by her head, but still Miss Caroline was acting like she couldn't see it. So I said, 'Oughtn't we to send for someone, miss? Oughtn't we to send for Dr. Faraday?' And she said, 'Yes, go and telephone for doctor. He'll see my mother's all right.' Then as I was going out the door, she calls after me in a different voice, 'Don't you tell him mind what's been done. Not over the telephone. Mother wouldn't want everyone hearing that. Say there's been an accident.' And after that, you see, doctor, she must have thought about what she'd said. When I went back in there, she was sitting down quietly at the side of the bed, and she just looked at me. And she said, 'She's dead, Betty,' as if I might not have knowed it. I said, 'Yes, miss, I know, and I'm ever so sorry.' And we just stopped there, the two of us, not knowing what else we should do. But then I got frit. I got frit terrible. I pulled on Miss Caroline's arm, and she rose to her feet like she were dreaming. We went out together, and I shut the door and turned the key. And it seems an awful thing to have done, to have left Mrs. Ayres lying in there all on her own. She was such a kind lady. She were always nice to me. And then it come to me how, just a bit before, we had been standing there in front of her door, wondering where she could be, not thinking anything of it, and peeping through the keyhole, and all the time, oh!"
She began to cry again.
"Why would she have done such a horrible thing to herself, Dr. Faraday? Why would she?"
It was a good hour or so after I'd arrived at the house that she told me all this, and by then I had been up to Mrs. Ayres's room myself. I had to nerve myself to go in there, standing at the door with my hand on the key. I, too, kept thinking of Caroline having been there before me, pushing the door and finding it blocked. My first sight of Mrs. Ayres's swollen, darkened face made me shudder. But worse was to come, for when I opened up her nightgown in order to examine her body, I found a score of little cuts and bruises, apparently all over her torso and limbs. Some were new, some almost faded. Most were simple scratches and nips. But one or two, I saw with horror, had the appearance almost of bites. The freshest, still smeared with blood, had clearly been made very shortly before her death. In other words, in that relatively brief space of time between Caroline's having left her at 5 o'clock and Betty's appearance with the breakfast tray at 8. What terror and despair must have gripped her in those 3 dark hours I couldn't imagine. The Verinals should have kept her sleeping long past the point of Caroline's departure. Instead, somehow, she had woken, had risen, had calculatedly closed and locked her bedroom door and disposed of the key, and begun the systematic business of torturing herself to death. Then I found myself recalling our conversation in the walled garden. I remembered those 3 springing drops of blood. My little girl, she isn't always kind. Was it possible? Was it? Or was it even worse than that? Suppose, in willing her daughter to come, she had only given strength and purpose to some other, darker thing. I couldn't bear to think of it. I drew up the blanket to put her from my sight. Like Betty, I found myself overcome by a strong, almost guilty desire to get away from the room and the horrors it suggested. I locked the door and went back down to the little parlour. I found Caroline still sitting blankly on the sofa. Betty had brought in tea, but the tea was cold in its cups, and the girl herself was moving between that room and the kitchen as if sleepwalking through the motions of her ordinary chores. I put her to make coffee, and when I had drunk a strong cup of that, I went slowly out to the hall to use the telephone. It was like a nightmarish echo of the previous evening. First, I called the district hospital to arrange for a mortuary van to be sent for Mrs. Ayres's body. Then, with more reluctance, I rang the local police sergeant to report the death. I gave the man the various details and arranged for him to come and take statements, and then I made my 3rd and final call. It was to Seeley. I caught him just at the end of his morning surgery. The line was bad, but I was glad of the crackles. I'd heard his voice, and for a moment my own had faltered. I said, "It's Faraday. I'm out at the house. Our patient, Seeley. I'm afraid she's beaten us."
"Beaten us?"
He couldn't hear or didn't understand. Then he caught his breath.
"Hell, I don't believe it. How was it done?"
"A bad way. I can't say."
"Of course you can't. God, this is terrible. After everything else."
"Yes, I know. But look here, the reason I'm calling, that Rugby woman I told you about, the nurse, do me a favour, will you? Call her for me and explain what's happened. I can't do it."
"Yes, of course."
I gave him the number. We spoke for another minute or two. He said again,
"A bloody awful business for the family, what's left of it. And for you, Faraday, I'm so sorry."
"It's my fault," I said. The line was still crackling, and he thought he'd misheard me. I said it again. I said, "I should have taken her. I had my chance."
"What? You're not seriously blaming yourself? Come on now, we've all seen this. When a patient has made up their mind to it, there's very little one can do to stop them. They become devious, you know that. Come on, man."
"Yes," I said. "I suppose so." But I was unconvinced by my own words, and when I had returned the earpiece to the stand, I glanced up through the curve of the staircase to Mrs. Ayres's door, and I found I had almost to creep abjectly away with my eyes lowered and my head bowed. I rejoined Caroline in the little parlour and sat beside her, holding her hand. Her fingers were as chill and anonymous in mine as those of a wax mannequin. I gently raised them to my lips, and she made no response. She only tilted her head as if listening for something. That made me listen too. We sat with frozen gestures, she with her inclined head, me with her hand still raised to my mouth, but the hall was soundless. There wasn't so much as the ticking of a clock. Life seemed held, arrested inside it. She caught my eye and said quietly,
"You feel it? The house is still at last. Whatever it was that was here, it has taken everything it wanted. And do you know what the worst thing is? The thing I shan't forgive it for? It made me help it."
Chapter 13. But that was all she would say on the matter. The police and the mortuary men arrived, and while the body was removed from the house, our statements, hers, mine, and Betty's, were taken down. When the men had left, she stood blankly again for a moment, but then, like a puppet being twitched into life, she seated herself at the writing table and began to make a list of all the things that must be done in the days ahead. On a separate sheet she wrote the names of the friends and relations who ought to be notified of her mother's death. I wanted her to leave it all until later. She shook her head, working doggedly on, and I realized at last that the chores were protecting her from the worst of her own shock, and were perhaps the best thing for her. I made her promise she would rest soon, take a sedative, and go to bed, and I took a tartan blanket from the sofa and tucked it round her to keep her warm. I left the house to the thud of closing shutters and the rattle of curtain rings. She had sent Betty to darken the rooms in an old-fashioned gesture of grief and respect. As I crossed the gravel, I heard the last of the shutters being closed, and when I looked back at the hall from the mouth of the drive, it appeared to be gazing, sightless with grief, across the hushed, white landscape. I didn't want to leave the house at all, but I had some dreary duties of my own now, and I drove, not home, but into Leamington, to discuss Mrs. Ayres's death with the borough coroner. I'd realized already that there was no concealing the facts of the case, no way of passing the death off, as I'd now and then done for other grieving families, as a natural one. But since I had effectively been treating Mrs. Ayres for mental instability, and had already seen evidence of self-violence, I had an ill-formed hope that I could save Caroline from the ordeal of an inquest. The coroner, however, though sympathetic, was a scrupulous man. The death had been sudden and violent. He would do his best to keep it a muted affair, but an inquest had to be held. "That means a post-mortem, too, of course," he said to me, "and since you're the notifying doctor, ordinarily I'd instruct you to carry it out yourself. Think you're up to it, though." He knew about my connection with the family. "There'd be no shame at all in your handing the task on." For a second or two I considered it. I have never relished post-mortems, and they are especially hard to perform when the patient in question has been a personal friend. At the same time I thought of giving Mrs. Ayres's poor marked body over to Graham or to Seeley, and my mind revolted from it. It seemed to me that I had let her down badly already. If there was no way of sparing her this final indignity, then the least I could do was to see the thing through myself, and see it done gently. So I shook my head and told him I would manage. And as it was now well past noon, with my morning surgery irrecoverable and the afternoon stretching blankly before me, when I left the coroner's office I went straight to the mortuary, to get the examination over with as quickly as I could. It was a horrible business, all the same, and I stood in the freezing white-tiled room with a covered body before me, the instruments waiting in the tray, wondering if I could really go through with it. Only once I had put back the sheet did I start to regain my nerve. The injuries were less shocking now that I knew what to expect. Those nips and cuts which had so unnerved me out at Hundreds began on inspection to lose some of their horror. I had supposed them to have covered almost Mrs. Ayres's entire body. Now I saw that most were located on areas that had been well within her own reach, her back, for example, being unmarked. What harm she had suffered, she had plainly caused herself. That was a relief to me, though I didn't quite know why. I pressed on and began the incisions. I expected secrets, I think, but no secrets came. There were no signs of illness, only the mundane deteriorations of age. There was no evidence that any sort of force had been used against Mrs. Ayres in her final days or hours, no damaged bones or internal bruising. Death was plainly the result of asphyxiation by hanging, completely compatible with the facts as Caroline and Betty had described them to me. Once again I found myself relieved. This time the feeling was unmistakable, and I realized I had had a darker reason for wanting to perform the post-mortem myself. I had been afraid of some detail emerging that would throw suspicion, I don't know what, I didn't know how exactly, on Caroline. I had still had that niggling doubt about her. Now, finally, the doubt was dispelled. I was ashamed I'd ever entertained it. I restored the body as best I could and passed my report on to the coroner. The inquest was held 3 days later, but with the evidence so pointed it was a very summary affair. The verdict returned was suicide whilst the balance of mind was disturbed, and the whole process took less than 30 minutes. The worst thing was the public nature of it all, for though the crowd was kept quite small, several newspaper men were present, and they made rather a nuisance of themselves as I took Caroline and Betty away from the court. The story appeared that week in all the Midland papers, and was swiftly taken up by a couple of nationals. One reporter came up from London and drove out to the hall, wanting to interview Caroline and passing himself off as a policeman in order to do it. She and Betty managed to get rid of him without too much trouble, but the thought of that kind of thing happening again appalled me. Remembering the time when the park had been briefly barricaded against the Baker Hydes, I resurrected those chains and padlocks and refastened the gates. I left one of the keys at the hall and kept the other on my own keychain. I had a duplicate cut from the key to the garden door, too. After that I felt happier, and could come and go from the house as I needed. Not surprisingly, Mrs. Ayres's suicide shocked and stunned the whole district. She had rarely been seen outside of Hundreds in recent years, but she was still a very well-known and well-liked figure, and for many days I couldn't walk through any of the villages without someone stopping me, keen to hear my side of the story, but also wanting to say how upset and sorry and disbelieving they were that such a lovely lady, such a real old-fashioned lady, so handsome and kind, should have done a dreadful thing like that, leaving those two poor children too. Many people asked where Roderick was and when he would be coming home. I said he was holidaying with friends and his sister was trying to get hold of him. Only to the Rossiters and the Desmonds did I give a truer account, for I didn't want them bothering Caroline with difficult questions. I told them frankly that Rod was in a nursing home being treated for a breakdown. Helen Desmond said at once, "But this is terrible. I can't believe it. Why didn't Caroline come to us sooner? We guessed the family was in trouble, but they seemed bent on managing things by themselves. Bill offered them help many times, you know, and they always refused. We thought it simply a question of money, if we had known things were so bad." I said, "I don't think any of us could have predicted this. But what's to be done? Caroline can't possibly stay out there now in that great big unhappy house. She should be with friends. She should come here to Bill and me. Oh, that poor, poor girl. Bill, we must go and get her."
"Of course we must," said Bill.
They were ready to leave for the hall at once. The Rossiters were exactly the same, but I wasn't sure Caroline would welcome the interference, however well-meant. I asked them to let me speak to her about it first, and, as I'd suspected, when I told her what they wanted for her, she shuddered.
"It's very kind of them," she said, "but the idea of being in someone else's house, with people watching every minute to see how I am, I just couldn't. I should be afraid of seeming too unhappy, or else of not seeming unhappy enough. I'd rather stay here. At least for now."
"Are you sure, Caroline?" Like everyone else, I felt terribly uneasy at the thought of her there, alone in that house, with only poor sad Betty for company. But she seemed very resolved to stay, so I went back to the Desmonds and the Rossiters, and this time when I spoke to them I made it plainer that Caroline was not quite as lonely and unsupported as they feared, that she was being pretty well cared for, in fact, by me. After a moment of misunderstanding, they took the hint, looking surprised. The Desmonds were quickest to congratulate me. They said it was by far the best thing that could happen to Caroline now, and a huge weight off their minds. The Rossiters, though polite, were more wary. Mr. Rossiter shook my hand amiably enough, but I could see his wife rapidly thinking the whole thing through, and I learned later that as soon as I left their house she called Caroline up to have the story confirmed. Caught off guard, distracted, tired, Caroline had little to say. Yes, I was being a great help to her. Yes, a wedding was planned. No, we had no date for it. She couldn't give it much thought yet. Everything was too unsettled. But after that, at least, there were no more attempts to persuade her from the house, and the Desmonds and the Rossiters must have quietly passed on news of our engagement to one or two of their neighbours, who must just as discreetly have passed it on to their own friends. Over the next few days I sensed the slightest of shifts in the district's attitude towards me. I began to be treated less as the heir's family physician, who might be companionably pumped for information about that dreadful business out at Hundreds, and more, almost, as a member of the family itself, worthy of respect and commiseration. The only person I spoke to directly about it was David Graham, and he was absolutely delighted by the news. He had known there was something afoot, he said, for months. Anne had scented it out, but they hadn't liked to press me. He only wished it hadn't taken such a tragedy to bring it all into the open. He insisted that Caroline be my priority for a while, arranging for the easing of my caseload, taking some of the patients himself. So in that first week after the death I spent a good part of each day at the hall, helping Caroline with her various chores, sometimes going for gentle walks with her in the gardens or the park, sometimes simply sitting with her in silence, holding her hand. She still gave the impression of being slightly insulated from her own grief, but I think my visits provided a structure for her patternless days. She never spoke about the house, but the house, oddly enough, continued to feel strikingly calm. Over the past few months I had watched life in it dwindle to what had felt like almost impossible proportions. Now, astonishingly, it dwindled further, became a matter of murmurs and quiet footsteps in two or three dim rooms. With the inquest out of the way, the next ordeal was the funeral. Caroline and I arranged it together, and it took place on the Friday of the following week. Given the nature of her mother's death, we both agreed that the event should be a subdued one. Our biggest dilemma at first was whether or not to involve Rod. It seemed out of the question that he should miss it, and we gave much serious thought as to how his presence could be managed, wondering, for example, if he mightn't come down from Birmingham in the company of a male attendant, who could be passed off as a friend. But we might have saved ourselves the debate. I myself drove up to the clinic to break the news of his mother's suicide, and his reaction horrified me. The loss itself he seemed hardly to register. It was the fact of her death that impressed him. For he saw it as evidence that she too had finally fallen victim to that diabolical infection he had struggled so hard to contain.
"It must have been waiting," he said to me, "all this time, breeding in the quiet of the house. I thought I'd beaten it, but you see what it's doing."
He reached across the table to grip my arm.
"No one's safe there now. Caroline, my God, you mustn't leave her there alone. She's in danger. You must get her away. You must get her right away from Hundreds."
For a moment I was unnerved. The warning almost rang true to me. Then I caught the wildness in his eye and saw how far beyond the reach of reason he had strayed, and realized that I was at risk of following him. I spoke calmly and rationally to him. That made his manner grow even wilder. A couple of nurses came running to restrain him, and I left him struggling and shouting in their arms. To Caroline I said only that he was no better. She could see from my expression what that meant. We gave up as hopeless our idea of his returning to Hundreds, even for a day, and with the Desmonds and Rossiter's help, we put out the story that he was abroad and unwell, and unable to make the journey home. How much anyone was really deceived by that, I don't know. I think rumours as to the real nature of his absence had been circulating for some time. Anyway, the funeral went ahead without him, and it went about as well, I suppose, as such a thing could. The coffin left from the hall, Caroline and I followed the hearse in the undertaker's car, and in the three or four cars that came after us there rode the closest family friends and those relations who had been able to make the difficult journey up to Hundreds from Sussex and Kent. The weather had lifted properly now, but the last of the snow was still on the ground. The black cars looked grimly impressive in the leafless white lanes, and all our attempts to keep the affair a low-key one came to nothing after all. The family was too well known, and the local feudal spirit too resilient. On top of that, there had always been more than a touch of tragic mystery to Hundreds Hall, and the newspaper coverage of Mrs. Ayres's death had only intensified it. At the gates of farms and cottages, people had gathered in solemn curiosity to see the coffin go by, and once we turned into Lidcote High Street we found the pavements crowded with watchers, falling silent as we approached, the men removing their hats and caps, a few of the women crying, but all of them craning for a better view. I thought of the time, nearly 30 years before, when I had stood beside my parents in my college blazer to watch another Ayres funeral, its coffin half the size of this one. I thought it with an almost giddy feeling, as if my life were twisting round its head to snap at its own tail. As we approached the church the crowd grew thicker, and I felt Caroline tense. I took her black-gloved hand and said quietly, "They want to show their respect, that's all." She raised her other hand to her face, trying to escape from their gazes.
"They're all looking at me. What are they looking for?"
I squeezed her fingers. "Be brave."
"I don't know if I can be."
"Yes, you can. Look at me. I'm here. I shan't leave you."
"No, don't leave me,"
she said, turning her face to me, gripping my hand as if the idea startled her. The church bell was tolling as we crossed the churchyard, unnaturally loud and plaintive in the crisp, windless air. Caroline kept her head lowered, her arm linked heavily with mine, but once we had entered the church itself she grew calmer, for then it was simply a question of getting through the service, making the correct responses and so on, and she did that in the efficient, perfunctory way she had done all the other tasks and duties of the past few days. She even joined in with the hymns. I had never heard her sing before. She sang as she spoke, tunefully, the words coming clean and whole from her well-shaped mouth. The service was not a long one, but the vicar, Mr. Spender, had known Mrs. Ayres for many years, and gave a feeling little speech about her. He called her an old-fashioned lady. Just the phrase I'd heard other people use. He said she was part of a different, more gracious age, as if she'd been rather older than she was, almost the last of her generation. He remembered the death of her daughter, Susan. He was sure, he said, that most of us remembered it, too. Mrs. Ayres, he reminded us, had walked behind her child's coffin that day, and it seemed to him that, in her heart, she must have continued to walk behind it every day of her life. Our consolation now in the tragedy of her death was to know that she had joined it. I glanced across the congregation as he spoke and saw many people nodding sadly at his words. None of them, of course, had seen Mrs. Ayres in her final few weeks, when she had been in the grip of a delusion so powerful, so grotesque, it had seemed almost to cast a spell of gloom and torment over the solid, inanimate objects around her. But as we made our way out to the churchyard, to the opened family plot, it seemed to me that perhaps Spender was right. There was no spell, there was no shadow, there was no kind of mystery. Things were very simple. Caroline stood beside me, blameless. Hundreds, a thing of brick and mortar, was blameless too, and Mrs. Ayres, unhappy Mrs. Ayres, was to be reunited with her lost little girl at last. The prayers were said, the coffin was lowered, and we moved away from the grave. People began to approach Caroline, wanting to exchange a few words of condolence with her. Jim Seeley and his wife shook her hand. They were followed by Morris Babb, the builder, and then by Graham and Anne. They stayed with her for several minutes, and while they spoke I saw that Seeley had hung back and was looking my way. After a slight hesitation I stepped aside to join him.
"A grim day," he murmured. "How's Caroline holding up?"
I said, "All things considered, pretty well. A bit withdrawn, that's all." He gazed over at her.
"Bound to be. I expect it's now she'll start to feel it. But you're looking after her."
"I am."
"Yes. Other people have commented on that. I think I'm to congratulate you, in fact."
I said, "It hardly feels like a day for congratulation, but," inclining my head, pleased and self-conscious. "Yes." He tapped my arm.
"I'm glad for you."
"Thanks, Seeley."
"Caroline, too. God knows she deserves her bit of happiness. If you take my advice, you won't hang about, the pair of you, once this is all out of the way. Get her away, give her a nice honeymoon, a fresh start, and so on."
"I intend to," I said.
"Good man."
His wife called to him. Caroline turned as if looking for me, and I went back to her side. Her arm moved heavily through mine again, and I wished with all my heart that I could simply take her home to hundreds and see her safely to her bed. But a party of people had been invited to the hall for the obligatory drinks, and there followed a trying few minutes as we worked out who could travel with whom, who might be squeezed into the undertaker's vehicles, and who could share a private car. Seeing Caroline growing anxious about it, I sent her off in the care of her Sussex uncle and aunt, and I ran to fetch my own Ruby, which had room for myself and three passengers. I was joined by the Desmonds and by a stray young man with a slight look of Roderick about him, who turned out to be Caroline's cousin on her father's side. He was a nice boy, sympathetic, but clearly not overly affected by Mrs. Ayres's death, for he kept up a light flow of conversation with us all the way to hundreds. He hadn't visited the hall in more than 10 years, and seemed naively pleased to have this chance to see the place again. He had used to come up here with his parents, he said, and had many happy memories of the house, the gardens, the park. He only fell silent as we started to bump our way along the tangled drive. When we broke free of the laurel and nettle and drew up on the sweep of gravel, I saw him looking at the blind-eyed house as if he couldn't believe it.
"You find it changed, I'm afraid," Bill Desmond said to him as the four of us climbed out.
"Changed," the boy said. "I wouldn't have known it as the same place. It looks like something from a horror film. No wonder my aunt—"
He bit off the words, embarrassed, his young cheek flaring. But as we joined the small crowd of mourners making their way to the little parlour, I could see other people looking around, clearly thinking the same thing. There were about 25 of us, too many, really, for the room, but there was simply nowhere else we could have gathered, and Caroline had made extra space by pushing back the little parlour furniture, unfortunately, in the process, exposing the worst of the threadbare carpets and the rips and wear in the furniture itself. To some of the guests, I suppose this looked no worse than eccentric, but to anyone who had known the hall in its grander days, the house's decline must have been shocking. Caroline's Sussex aunt and uncle in particular had already had a good look round. They had seen the saloon with its sagging ceiling and its torn wallpaper, and the blackened ruin that had once been Roderick's room, and they had gazed across the unkempt park at the breach in the wall and at the red council houses which seemed to have sprung up inside it like so many toadstools. They still looked stunned. Like the Desmonds and the Rossiters, they thought it out of the question that Caroline should remain at the hall alone. When I went in, they had drawn her aside and were trying to persuade her to return with them to Sussex that afternoon. She was shaking her head.
"I can't think about leaving just yet," I heard her say. "I can't think about anything yet." "Well, all the more reason for us to look after you, surely. Please."
She tucked back her hair, her fingers clumsy, the hair separating into strands across her cheek. She was dressed in a plain black gown, and her throat was exposed, so pale one could see the veins in it, blue as bruises.
"Please don't go on about it," she was saying as I went over to her side. "I know you're only trying to be kind."
I touched her arm, and she turned to me, grateful. She said in a softer voice,
"You're here. Has everyone arrived?"
"Yes," I said gently. "Everyone's here. You mustn't worry. Everything's fine. Would you like a drink, something to eat?" The table had a spread of sandwiches on it. Betty was beside it, filling plates, pouring drinks, her cheek almost as white as Caroline's, and her eyes red. She hadn't come to the funeral. She had stayed here, getting things ready. Caroline shook her head as if the idea of food made her queasy.
"I'm not hungry."
"I think a glass of sherry would do you good."
"No, not even that. But perhaps my aunt and uncle?"
The aunt and uncle, for the moment, seemed relieved that I had arrived. I had been introduced to them before the funeral as the family doctor. We had spoken a little about Mrs. Ayres's illness and about Roderick's, and I think they had been glad to see how closely I was keeping at Caroline's side. For, not unnaturally, they supposed my presence to be a mainly professional one, and Caroline looked so desperately tired and pale. Now the aunt said,
"Doctor, do back us up. It would be different if Roderick were here, but Caroline can't stay on in this great house all by herself. We want her to come to Sussex with us."
"And what does Caroline want?" I said. The woman drew in her chin. She resembled her sister, Mrs. Ayres, but was built on a larger, less charming scale. She said,
"All things considered, I don't think Caroline is in much of a position to know what she wants. She's dropping on her feet. Surely a change of scene can only be good for her. As her doctor, you must agree."
"As her doctor," I said, "I probably do. In other respects, well, I'm afraid I shouldn't be at all happy to see Caroline leave Warwickshire just now." I smiled as I said this, and returned my hand to Caroline's arm. Caroline shifted, conscious of the pressure of my fingers, but I think most of what had been said had passed her by. She was gazing around the room, anxious that all was as it should be. I saw her aunt's expression change. There was a pause. Then she said, in a slightly crisper tone,
"I'm afraid I've forgotten your name, Doctor."
I repeated it. She said,
"Faraday." "No, I don't believe my sister ever mentioned you."
I said, "I don't imagine she did. But we were talking about Caroline, I think.
Caroline's in a rather vulnerable state."
"I quite agree with you.
When I think of her here, alone and friendless—"
"But she's hardly that. Look about you. She has many friends. More, I think, than she would have in Sussex." The woman gazed at me, frustrated. She turned to her niece.
"Caroline, do you truly want to stay here? I shan't be easy about it, you know. If anything should happen to you, your uncle and I would never forgive ourselves."
"Happen to me?"
said Caroline, puzzled, her attention drawn back to us.
"What do you mean? I mean if something should happen to you here while you are alone in this house."
"But nothing can happen to me now, Aunt Sissy," Caroline said. "There's nothing left to happen."
She was speaking seriously, I think. But the older woman looked at her, and perhaps imagined that she was making a grim attempt at humour. I saw, in her expression, the faintest stirring of distaste.
"Well, of course you aren't a child," she said, "and your uncle and I can't force you."
At that point the discussion was broken up by the arrival of another guest. Caroline excused herself and moved dutifully to greet him, and I also moved on. The gathering, understandably, was a very subdued one. There were no speeches, no attempts to follow the vicar's example and find some touches of comfort in the gloom. It seemed harder to do that here, with the obvious derangement of the house and landscape so brutally recalling that of Mrs. Ayres herself. And it was impossible not to remember that the suicide had happened in a room just a few feet over our heads. People stood about, talking awkwardly, in murmurs, not as if simply unhappy, but as if unsettled, unnerved. Now and then they would glance at Caroline, as her aunt had, with a touch of disquiet. As I moved from group to group, I heard several people quietly speculating on what would happen to the hall now, confident, apparently, that Caroline would have to give it up, that the place could have no future. I began to resent them all. It seemed to me that they had come here, knowing nothing about the house, and nothing about Caroline and what was best for her, yet were making judgments and assumptions as if that were their right. I was relieved when, after an hour or so, people began to apologize and slip away. Because so many had shared vehicles, the crowd thinned very quickly. Soon, too, the visitors from Sussex and Kent began to look at their watches, thinking of the long, uncomfortable car rides or train journeys ahead of them. One by one they went to Caroline to say their emotional goodbyes, to kiss and embrace her. The aunt and uncle made one last fruitless attempt to persuade her to leave. I saw her growing tireder with every farewell. She was like a flower, being passed from hand to hand, wilting and bruising. When the final guests left, she and I went with them to the front door to stand on the cracked steps and watch their cars rasp away across the gravel. Then she closed her eyes and covered her face. Her shoulders sank, and it was all I could do to catch her in my arms and lead her, stumbling, back to the warmth of the little parlour. I put her to sit in one of the wing-backed chairs, her mother's chair it had used to be, beside the fire. She rubbed her forehead.
"Is it really over? This has been the longest day of my life. I think my head is about to burst."
"I'm surprised you haven't fainted," I said. "You've eaten nothing."
"I can't. I can't."
"Just a little something. Please." But she wouldn't take food, no matter what I offered. So finally I mixed her up a glass of sherry, sugar, and hot water, and she drank that with a couple of aspirins while I stood and watched. When Betty began to clear the table and rearrange the room, she automatically rose to help. I gently but firmly pushed her back down and brought her extra cushions and a blanket, and I took the shoes from her feet and briefly rubbed her stockinged toes. She looked on unhappily as Betty gathered plates, but soon her weariness overtook her. She drew up her legs, rested her cheek against the worn velvet nap of the chair, and closed her eyes. I looked at Betty, touching my finger to my lips. We worked quietly together, gently loading trays, tiptoeing with them from the room, and down in the kitchen I took off my jacket and stood at the girl's side, drying the crockery and glasses as she passed them, soapy, from the sink. She didn't seem to find it odd. I didn't find it odd either. The hall had been knocked out of its routines, and there was a comfort to be had. I'd seen it in other bereaved houses, in little ordinary chores conscientiously done. But when the washing up was finished, her narrow shoulders drooped, and partly because I'd begun to realize how hungry I was, but also simply to keep her occupied, I had her heat up a pan of soup, and we took a bowlful each to the table. And as I set down my bowl and spoon on the table's scrubbed deal top, I found myself growing thoughtful. I said, "The last time I sat down to eat at this table, Betty, I was 10 years old. My mother was with me, sitting just where you are." She turned up her tear-reddened eyes to me, uncertainly.
"Is it a funny thought, sir?"
I smiled. "It is, a bit. I certainly never guessed then that I'd be back here one day quite like this. I dare say my mother never guessed it either. A pity she didn't live to see it. I wish I'd been kinder to my mother, Betty. My father, too. I hope you're nicer to your parents." She put an elbow on the table and rested her cheek on her hand.
"They get on me nerves," she said with a sigh. "My dad made all that fuss about me coming out here. Now he's on at me to leave."
I said, alarmed, "He isn't, is he?"
"He is. He's been reading all the papers, and he says the house is turned too queer. Mrs. Baisley says the same. She came in this morning, but when she went she took her apron. She says she ain't going to come back again. She says what happened with Madam was too much. Her nerves ain't up to it. She says she'd sooner take in laundry like a washing woman. I don't think she's told Miss Caroline yet."
I said, "Well, I'm very sorry to hear it. You're not going to give your notice, are you?" She ate her soup, not looking at me.
"I don't know. It ain't the same without Madam."
"Oh, Betty, please don't. I know the house is an unhappy one just now, but we're all Miss Caroline has left, you and I. I can't be here all the time to keep an eye on her, but you can. If you were to leave...
I don't want to leave. Not really.
I don't want to go back home anyway. It's just me dad.
She sounded genuinely torn, and I found her loyalty to the house, after everything that had happened, rather touching. I watched her eat a little more, thinking over what she'd told me. Then I said cautiously, "How about if you were able to tell your father? Well, that things might soon be changing here at Hundreds." I hesitated. "If you were able to tell him, say, that Miss Caroline was going to be married."
"Married?"
She looked amazed.
"Who to?"
I smiled. "Well, who do you think?" She understood and blushed, and stupidly I blushed too. I said, "Now you're not to go talking about it. Some people know, most people don't." She had straightened up, growing excited.
"Oh, when is it to be?"
"I don't know yet. It hasn't been fixed."
"And what will Miss Caroline wear? Will it have to be black because of Madam?"
I said, "Good heavens, I don't think so. This isn't the 1890s. Come on now, eat your soup." But her eyes were filling with tears. She said,
"Oh, but ain't it a shame that Madam won't be here to see it? And who's to give Miss Caroline away? It ought to be Mr. Roderick, oughtn't it?"
"Well, I fear Mr. Roderick will still be too poorly."
"Who will it be, then?"
"I don't know. Mr. Desmond, perhaps. Or perhaps nobody. Miss Caroline can give herself away, can't she?" She looked horrified.
"She can't do that."
We talked it over for a few more minutes, both of us glad of the lightness of the subject after that hard day. When we had finished our dinners, she wiped her eyes and blew her nose, then took the bowls and spoons to the sink. I put my jacket back on, then ladled out another portion of soup and set it, covered, on a tray to take upstairs to the little parlour. I found Caroline still sleeping, but as I drew near her she woke with a start, putting down her legs and half rising. Her cheek was marked, like creased linen, where it had rested against the chair. She said, still partly in her dream,
"What time is it?"
"It's 6:30. I brought you some soup, look."
"Oh."
Her expression cleared. She rubbed her face.
"I really don't think I can eat."
But I put the tray across the arms of her chair, effectively pinning her behind it. Laying a napkin in her lap, I said, "Just try a little, will you? I'm afraid of you growing ill."
"I don't want it, truly."
"Come on, or you'll hurt Betty's feelings. You'll hurt mine, too." "Good girl." For she had picked up her spoon and begun half-heartedly to stir the soup. I brought across a footstool and sat at her side, putting my chin on my fist and solemnly watching her, and she started to eat, very slowly, one small mouthful at a time. She did it quite without relish, plainly forcing the morsels of meat and vegetable down, but when she had finished she looked better, with colour in her cheeks. Her head, she said, was aching less. She felt only so desperately weary. I moved aside the tray and took her hand, but she drew it from me, putting it instead across her mouth while she yawned and yawned, her eyes watering. Then she wiped her face and sat forward in the chair, moving closer to the fire.
"God," she said, gazing into the flames, "today has been just like a horrible dream." "But it wasn't a dream, was it? My mother's dead. Dead and buried. And now she'll be dead and buried forever. I can't believe it. It seems to me that she must be just upstairs, resting. And when I was dozing before, I could nearly imagine that Roddy was out there in his room and that Jip was here beside my chair."
She raised her eyes to me, bewildered.
"How did it happen? Any of it?"
I shook my head. "I don't know. I wish I did."
"I heard a woman say today that this house must be cursed."
"Who said that? Who was she?"
"I didn't know her. A newcomer, I think. It was in the churchyard. I heard her say it to somebody else. She looked at me as if I were cursed, too. As if I were Dracula's daughter."
She yawned again.
"Oh, why am I so tired? All I want to do is sleep."
"Well, that's probably about the best thing you can do. I only wish you didn't have to do it here all on your own." She rubbed her eyes.
"You sound like Aunt Sissy. Betty will look after me."
"Betty's exhausted, too. Let me put you into your bed." Then, seeing something in her expression, I added, "Not like that. What kind of brute do you take me for? "You're forgetting I'm a doctor. I see young women into their beds all the time."
"But I'm not your patient, am I?" "You must go home."
"I don't like to leave you."
"I'm Dracula's daughter, remember? I'll be all right."
She got to her feet. She almost swayed as she did it, and I caught hold of her shoulders to steady her, then stroked the brown hair away from her forehead and cupped her face with my hands. She closed her eyes. As they often did when she was tired, her eyes looked nude, moist, swollen. I kissed them lightly. Her arms hung loose as a jointed doll's. She opened her eyes and said, more firmly than before,
"You must go home. But thank you for everything you've done. You've been so good to us today."
She checked herself.
"So good to me, I mean."
I found my coat and hat and took her hand, and we went out to the hall. It was chill there, and I saw her shiver. I didn't want to keep her standing in the cold, but when we had kissed and moved apart, and her hand was tugging away from mine, I glanced over her shoulder to the staircase, thinking of the dark, empty rooms above. And the sight of her moving off alone like that after the day she had had was dreadful. I tightened my grip on her fingers and pulled her back. "Caroline," I said. She came slackly, protesting.
"Please, I'm so tired."
I drew her close and spoke quietly into her ear. "Tell me just one thing. When may we be married?" Her face moved against mine.
"I must go to bed."
"When, Caroline?"
"Soon."
"I want to be here with you."
"I know. I know you do."
"I've been patient, haven't I?"
"Yes. But not right away. Not so soon after Mother."
"No, no. But perhaps in a month?" She shook her head.
"We can talk tomorrow."
"A month will be just long enough, I think. I mean for sorting out the license, things like that. But I shall need to plan, you see. If we could just settle on a date—"
"There are so many things to discuss."
"Not the important things, surely. Can we say a month? Or at most 6 weeks? 6 weeks from today?" She hesitated, struggling with weariness. Then,
"Yes,"
she said, pulling away.
"Yes, if you like. Only let me go to bed. I'm so, so tired."
It seems an odd thing to say, given all the terrible things that had happened, but I remember the period following the funeral as one of the brightest of my life. I left the house bursting with plans. The very next day I went into Leamington to put in the application for the wedding license, and a few days later the date was fixed, Thursday, the 27th of May. As if in anticipation of the event, over the next couple of weeks the weather grew finer, and the days visibly lengthened. The leafless trees and flowerless landscape seemed suddenly tense with colour and life. The hall had stayed shuttered since the morning of Mrs. Ayres's death, and in contrast with the stir of the season and the clear blue skies, the gloom and the hush began to feel oppressive. I asked Caroline's permission to open up the house, and on the last day of April I went through all the ground-floor rooms, carefully drawing back the shutters. Some had been closed for months. They groaned on their hinges, the dust clouding, the paintwork crackling and flaking. But the sounds, to me, were those of a creature gratefully surfacing from a long slumber, and the wooden floors creaked almost luxuriously as the warm day met them, like cats extending themselves in the sun. I wanted to see Caroline herself, returning to life like that. I wanted gently to kindle and rouse her. For now that the first phase of grief had passed, her spirits had sunk a little. With no more letters to write and no funeral arrangements absorbing her, she grew aimless and listless. I'd had to resume my surgeries and rounds, which meant leaving her alone for long stretches of time. With Mrs. Baisley gone, there were many chores she might have seen to, but Betty told me that she did nothing with her days but sit, or gaze blankly from the windows, sighing, yawning, smoking cigarettes, biting her nails. She seemed unable to plan for the wedding, or for any of the changes that would follow. She took no interest in the estate, the garden, the farm. She had lost even her ability to read. The books bored and frustrated her, she said. The words seemed to glance against her brain as if it were made of glass. Remembering Celia's words at the funeral, "Get her away, a fresh start," I started to think about our honeymoon. I imagined all the good it would do her to be taken out of the county, right out to a completely different landscape, to mountains, or beaches and cliffs. For a time I considered Scotland.
Then I thought, perhaps, the lakes. Then, quite by chance, one of my private patients mentioned Cornwall to me, describing an hotel he had recently stayed at in one of the coves. A wonderful place, he said it was, quiet, romantic, picturesque. It seemed like fate. Without saying anything to Caroline, I found out the hotel's address, made inquiries, and reserved a room for a week, for Dr. and Mrs. Faraday. The wedding night itself I thought we could spend on the sleeper train out of London. It had a silly sort of glamour to it I suspected Caroline would like. And in the many lonely hours when I was separated from her, I thought often of the journey. The narrow British Railways bunk, the sliver of moonlight at the blind, the guard going delicately past the door, the gentle jog and rumble of the train on the shining track. Meanwhile, the wedding itself crept nearer, and I tried to encourage her to plan for the ceremony. "I'd like to have David Graham, you know, as my best man," I told her, as we strolled in the park one Sunday afternoon in early May. "He's been a good friend to me. Anne must come, too, of course. And you had better choose your bridesmaid, Caroline." We were walking through bluebells. Almost overnight, the rough ground at Hundreds had been transformed with them, through acre after acre. She stooped to pick one and rolled the stem of it between her fingers, frowning down at the flowers as they whirled.
"A bridesmaid," she repeated dully as we moved on. "Must I, though?"
I laughed. "You must have a bridesmaid, darling. Someone to hold your bouquet."
"I hadn't thought. There's no one I quite like to ask."
"There must be someone. What about that friend of yours from the hospital dance? Brenda, was it?" She blinked.
"Brenda? Oh, no, I shouldn't like... No."
"Then how about Helen Desmond as, what do you call it, matron of honour? She'd be touched, I think." She had begun to pick apart the blue flowers, clumsily separating the petals with her bitten-down nails.
"I suppose she would."
"All right. I'll call in, shall I, and mention it to her." She frowned again.
"You needn't do that. I can speak to her myself."
"I don't want you to be bothered with all the little details."
"A bride is supposed to be bothered with them, isn't she?"
"Not a bride," I said, "who's been through all the things that you have." I put my arm through hers. "I want to make this easy for you, darling."
"Easy for me?"
she said, resisting the pull of my hand.
"Or..."
She didn't finish. I stopped and stared at her. "What do you mean?" Her head was still lowered. She was still working at the petals. She said, without looking up,
"All I mean is, must things really move so quickly?"
"Well, what have we to wait for?"
"I don't know. Nothing, I suppose. I just wish people wouldn't keep going on about it to me. Yesterday Paget's man congratulated me when he brought the meat. Betty can talk of nothing else."
I smiled. "What harm can it do? People are pleased."
"Are they? More likely they're laughing. People always do when a spinster marries. I expect they think it's funny that I'm coming off the shelf, as if I've been brought from the back of the display, had the dust blown off me."
I said, "Is that what you think I've done? Blown the dust off you?" She threw away the mangled flower and said, tiredly and almost crossly,
"Oh, I don't know what you've done."
Catching hold of her hands, I drew her round to face me. "I happen," I said, "to have fallen in love with you. If people want to laugh at that, they must have a bloody silly sense of humour." I had never spoken to her in quite those terms before, and for a second she looked startled. Then she closed her eyes and turned her head from me. The sun caught her hair. I saw a thread of grey in the brown.
"I'm sorry," she murmured. "You're always so good, aren't you? And I'm always so beastly. It's hard, that's all. So much has changed. But in other ways nothing seems to have changed at all."
I put my arms around her and pulled her close. "We can make all the changes we want once Hundreds is our own." Her cheek was resting on my shoulder, but I could tell from the intentness of her pose that she had opened her eyes and was gazing back across the park at the house. She said,
"We've never talked about how it will be. I'll be a doctor's wife."
I said, "You'll be marvellous at it, you'll see." She drew back to look at me.
"But how will it work? With you? With Hundreds? You keep talking about the estate as though you'll have time and money to fix it. How will it work?"
I gazed into her face, wanting only to reassure her, but the truth is I didn't quite know how it would work. I had recently told Graham about my plan to move into the hall after the wedding, and he had seemed taken aback. He had been supposing, he said, that Caroline would give hundreds up, that she and I would live at Gill's or find a nicer house together. I told him in the end that nothing was settled, that Caroline and I were still playing with ideas.